So we asked the question of 400 clergy, how do you know you're okay? What do you look at? So there's about 45 different things, but the six that were clearly at the top, and the first one that was right at the top, and I don't think it was asked in a way that pushed in this direction, but it was reassuring, is when I'm seeing God at work, there's something around that area. It's like if I have a sense that God is with me in it, that he's doing something through me, that he's giving a sense of direction, a whole range of different things that people said. Because I think it's, I mean, because the negative indicator is the opposite in all of these cases, isn't it? If I can't see God at work, that often feels like a very lowering kind of thing for those of us that are in ministry, much as we can get caught up with our own agenda. The bottom line is that we're serving someone else. And when we can see God at work, that seemed to be a positive indicator. The second thing that was mentioned was the mood at the beginning and end of each day. Because most of us are public people, aren't we? You know, if we're taking the funeral of a child and we've got a child of the same age, it messes with our emotions. But we can pull it together. We can go to the crematorium, we can lead the service. But outside of that space, there's a whole lot of other stuff taking place. And a number of clergy said, when I wake up in the morning, now I'm terrible in the morning, so I always feel terrible in the morning. It's not a good indicator for me. But you know, some people would say, if I wake up in the morning and I'm sort of dreading the day, not just on one occasion, but that's a recurring pattern. It's an indicator that my heart is losing track of what it's about. And others said the mood at the end of the day when everything quietens down. I think this is why the examine can be so helpful, just that sort of, well, this is where I am at and I give it back to God as part of my offering of the day. Mood at the beginning and the end of the day when the public has gone, we're alone with our thoughts. If they continue to be negative, it could be an indicator. Third thing people said, it was something about the time off and sense of life being under control. It's not just whether I'm getting a day off, but whether I feel like the time I'm taking off is having the effect that it's supposed to have. I'm now convinced that some of us need more time off than others, and there's no kind of golden rule in there, but we are expected to live with a pattern. And what people are saying is that when they enter a period where they've had time off, but it doesn't seem to have changed anything, you're not coming back refreshed, it doesn't seem to be having the impact. It's a negative indicator. Because time off is often a symptom, not always, of the rest of life being under control. And it relates to the fourth thing, which is something about, vision might be too technical a word, but it's something about, I know where I'm going and I know what I'm here for. And clergy seem to be saying that when they didn't have a clear sense of being on a journey, you know, with God, yes, but towards something, then there's a sense of you lose what you prioritise. In the book Good to Great, there's a little phrase that says, I can more readily say no if I have a bigger yes. And it's something about the bigger yes. If we're just turning the handle and everything's responsive, we're responding to emails, we're doing what we need to do, but there's not a sense of I know where I'm going. That seemed to be an indicator for people. Number five, a general sense of joy and happiness. I think somebody mentioned that about emotions. The phrase that we often read was something like, I'm doing the things that I enjoy, but it's not having the effect that is normal. I'm going to the theatre, but I'm not enjoying it because my head is thinking about other things or you know, whatever it is that you enjoy doing. And the final sixth thing, and this probably covered, these six probably covered the majority of people's responses, a sense of being supported and working in partnership. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you've got a team, but maybe there's a mentor or there's a spiritual director or a soul friend or somebody in the background. It may be a spouse, a partner, there might be somebody, but I'm not kind of on the front line on my own. I feel like I've got people alongside me. Philippians says, contending shoulder to shoulder for the sake of the gospel. I think we're designed to be collaborative workers, but when people felt that they weren't supported and they didn't have a sense of partnership, exposed or alone, that was one of the negative indicators. So just have a look at that list, and maybe just at this part of the occasion, you might just see if there's anything in there that you do connect with. Because all of these things we can address, can't we? They're sort of under our control, apart from number one maybe, but there's things we can do to help that. Is there anything there you want to note down just to come back to? Often when I'm talking to clergy who are thinking maybe it's time for a move, they might say, I've lost a sense of vision for where I am, and that's one of the indicators. But then the question is, so what kind of vision is God opening up for you regarding a next step or something else that you might do? How are we doing in those? Right, I just want to take a little sidestep. We're going to come back to this research in a moment. But one of the words that the business world has been using to describe the last 2 years or 3 years, actually more than that, sort of 5 years, is a new word, which is the word VUCA, which I just want to briefly reflect upon, because this research was done before the interruptions of COVID and all the other associated things as well. Now, during COVID, we tracked some of the indicators of the morale stuff amongst church leaders. Some of you may know that we ran things called Leadership in Lockdown, which were webinars that took place right through the COVID period. And we had hundreds, on some occasions, thousands of people join in with those webinars. And we asked people to indicate some of the mood type answers that happened. And what we noticed is that in the early days of the lockdown, there was quite a big division with people that were going up and people who were going down. So a number of church leaders were saying, you know what, I've lost all of my markers for what I'm about. We're no longer sharing the Eucharist. We're no longer singing songs of praise. We're no longer having coffee together. I've lost any sense of awareness of where I am in this. And it led to some kind of a nosedive. And almost by contrast, there were others that were saying, there's something about this new situation that is sparking me up and making me think, what can we do? And it was almost like when the lockdown thing hit, you know, some of us went that way and some of us went that way. And this group was saying, I'm feeling energized, I'm feeling excited about the future, I'm feeling motivated. And these group were saying, I'm feeling lost and uncertain. It's almost that stark. And I think probably as it continued, gradually, you know, we came back together because we began to know what we were about, what we could do, what we couldn't do, began to adjust to that and so on. There is a certain amount of research at the moment that is saying that in terms of morale amongst clergy, it's a little bit lower than it is amongst congregations. Barna has done some research on this, and what they're saying is that as far as congregation, I mean, this is an awful division to make, but I can in this context, I think, as far as congregations are concerned, you know, they're kind of moving on in things. You know, life has sort of moved on, perhaps in work and so on. But there's something about that clergy have been through so many changes over the last 2.5 years that they're just lagging a little bit behind in terms of adjusting to the new normal, if there is such a thing, which I think is interesting. But I just want to talk briefly about this word that's being used. But nothing's working now, so... Who knows? Dodgy wires. So in the business world, and church leaders are beginning to say, we see this replicated in the life of church communities. Four words have described the business world, and they're not all the same words. They're all very different, and our reaction to each of these words needs to be different. The first word is the word volatility. Volatility means that a lot of things could happen which are unpredictable. That's the nature of volatility. Now, in my mind, I'm thinking that what happened when Liz Truss was made Prime Minister and the, what's it being called, the kamikaze mini budget. I mean, estimates is something like it cost the country about 30 billion, something like that, you know. I mean, that's an unpredictable event. Maybe some would have predicted it, but it's we're not going there. We're not going there. Pray for those in authority. It's an unpredictable event, but of course it is in reaction to a whole lot of other things. It's reacting to global markets. It's reacting to supply chains. It's reacting to the fact that certain things aren't. I mean, you know, it's all interconnected, isn't it? There's a volatility in both the markets, in supply chains, in politics, in Europe at the moment. And no one can predict what's going to come out of the boil. That's the first word. The second one is related, but it's not always the same. I mean, it's possible for things to be volatile, but uncertainty can happen even when things aren't volatile. But uncertainty is the second word that's being used. And uncertainty means that although there's volatility and we can't predict what's going to happen in the future, that means that I feel uncertain about decisions that I'm making right now. My son is 35. He's been working in London. They've just moved out. And he and his wife are thinking about buying a house. That's what they were planning to do. Now they haven't done it. Why? Because people are saying, well, the house prices are going to go down and the mortgages have gone this way. And you know, so there's uncertainty, which is not the same as volatility, but it's related. This is all uncertain as well, isn't it? I'm just getting random stuff come up in here. The programme for our staff day has just come up on my screen. I know where... But that's already happened. I don't know what's going on here. But anyway, the third word, volatility, uncertainty, the C is complexity. And complexity is to do with the fact that nothing is in isolation, but it's all related. So the markets are related to what's happening in Ukraine, and the supply chains are affected by that. So there's kind of complexity. It's not like, well, if we just flick this switch, everything becomes organized. You flick this switch and something else happens over here because connectedness. And the fourth word is the word ambiguity. Ambiguity. And what's meant by ambiguity is that not everyone would say that the things that are volatile or uncertain are good or bad. There will be differing opinions about that. And again, we're not particularly going there, but in England, the letter that was written by the Bishop of Oxford about LGBT stuff, it's another one of those. I mean, we haven't looked at living in love and faith in England for 2 years because everything else has been so disrupted. And then, of course, something arrives and people will react differently. Some will say, well, this is a great thing, and other people will say, this is a terrible thing. So ambiguity is part of the VUCA sort of scene. And those who are commentating on it, Nate Bennett, who is writing in the Harvest, in the Harvard Business Review, described VUCA as being, hey, it's crazy out there. It's very difficult to predict what will happen and what the effect of that will be. Now, those who are commentating on the church world are saying, well, of course, if the VUCA world is impacting with volatility, uncertainty, complexity and ambiguity, the lives of the people who are members of our community, then it will be seen in our lives as well. And I see it in England with regard to dioceses who are trying to work out the budgets for the next few years and are saying, we don't know what we can afford, we don't know what shape of ministry we're going to go for, we're pressing pause on these appointments and applications and so on, because there's this sort of, we don't quite know what to do. That's the VUCA world. Does that make sense? Oh, look, it's coming back to life again. I've still got the staff day program on here, but I don't know whether it's... Oh. Anyway, so it's great, isn't it? It's great. Uncertainty. Anyway, now before you know want to stab yourself and think, isn't life terrible? Can I? My observation is that the gospel came to us. The life of Jesus was lived in a VUCA time. It came out of uncertainty. That when Jesus said that he was the rock, he was the cornerstone, the foundation, the solid rock on which if you build a house, it stands. Jesus was wanting to say, I know that the world around is volatile. We don't know what the Romans are going to do, whether the Jews are going to have authority, whether Herod's going to resign and so on. It's an uncertain world. And Jesus said, in this world you will have trouble. But be of good heart, I have overcome, I'm the rock. I am your security in a volatile time. He talked about uncertainty and, you know, Jesus Christ, a sure and certain hope. You know, hope is not optimism about the future. Hope is saying, I view the future differently. Because I know that God, who is faithful and with me now, will be faithful and with me in the future. In terms of complexity, Jesus offered us actually a very simple foundation for our discipleship. I gather that the European Commission on the Export of Duck Eggs has over 15,000 words. The Lord's Prayer has 67. Jesus encapsulated in one prayer the aspirations of the kingdom. In one commandment with two parts, the aspirations of 10. And in one commission, a simple definition of our purpose as the church. One prayer, one rule, one call. And in the ambiguity of, well, you know, is Rishi going to be the best solution? Is Liz going to be, do we need a general election? Do we need this? Do we need that? In all the uncertainty, Jesus simply looked his disciples in the eyes and said, come and follow me. Follow me. It's a simple invitation, however complicated we make it. So therefore, in this last bit, I'd love us to move from what are the indicators of, you know, how our morale is, into the question of, well, when we're going through a period where we feel we're going cold, where our heart needs a bit of guarding, maybe a darker period and less certain period where we, not the world out there, but the world in here is VUCA, what do we do about it? We did research about that as well, but I want to ask what you do about it. Maybe you've already had a conversation about it, but what do you do? And I'm not talking here that you've had a really busy couple of days and you need a night with Netflix and a pepperoni pizza. You know that. You know, I know that. But when there's been a few days or a few weeks of waking up and feeling anxiety about the day, or you know, or when the road rage has been with you, you know, for a couple of weeks, when the heart is growing cold, what have you done? What do you do that makes a difference? I'll tell you what other people do, but maybe you could just talk to each other now about what you do, and we'll take some feedback in about 4 or 5 minutes. But what have you done? What do you do? What would you do in order to turn things around? I think there's two responses I've seen in some of this research that Most commonly, people don't take their rest, and therefore everything spills into everything, and there's no sense of release. The other extreme, of course, is when people withdraw by taking lots of rest, and actually find it very difficult to emerge from the rest. And I think, again, you know, it's just reading your own reactions and working out the stepping stones to recovery. Last comment, thank you.
Well, I was going to say much the same as Adrian said, except sort of narrowing the focus.
Yeah.
So that if the big picture is so overwhelming, you look at small things, bite-sized chunks, like you said. Yeah. If you've got to eat an elephant, you make it into sandwiches. Mm. And so just finding little things to be thankful for, counting your blessings, really.
Yes.
And letting them build up gradually.
Yeah. Thank you. Someone who's much older and wiser than me, who was writing about the experience of lockdown, suggested to Christian leaders, define three things you're going to do in a day, write them down, tick them off. When everything felt chaotic, you know, just three things. They don't have to be big things, but just the sense of rebuilding some momentum in your own personal life. Yeah, okay, thank you. Well, I just want to conclude with the six top things that people came back with, and if you'll bear with me, I'd love to relate them to 2 Corinthians, because that's where the initiative came from. So number one, say it as it is, like it is. Who can we talk to without pretense? Thanks, we've already had that as a suggestion. But if you look at the writings of 2 Corinthians, not only does it say at the beginning, we were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, we despaired even of life. Later on in chapter 6, we read that section where he says, we were in troubles, hardships, stresses, beatings, imprisonments, hard work, sleepless nights, and also I carry the burden of the churches for which I'm responsible, he said. It feels like there's an openness to saying, this is what I'm struggling with. And so who do you do that with? I mean, number one, who do you do that with? Just one comment, perhaps for those of us that are married. I think there's been one or two times in my life and career where I've used my wife in an unhelpful way in this, you know, almost treated her as a sort of handy mentor or spiritual director. I think she would have said in the past that sometimes I tell her when I'm struggling with things and then forget to tell her when I'm not struggling anymore, and she would carry it. So I think you know, it's great if we do have supportive spouses or family members. I'm now at a point where my kids are old enough to be a good support too, but it's using them appropriately, I think, and if we need a pastoral supervisor, then to ask somebody to be a pastoral supervisor, not try and get somebody else in that role. Say it like it is. We do need to be able to say it like it is, and I think if we don't have appropriate outlets for that, it'll come out in less appropriate ways. And perhaps we all know of people who've perhaps been over vulnerable in the way that they've talked about their struggles, and actually added to the sense of uncertainty and instability in communities. I mean, I do think that's partly what archdeacons are there for. I certainly tried to be a listening ear. I realise it sometimes feels they're part of the structures, but most dioceses also have resources outside the structures that you can talk to too. But it's never a sign of weakness if you need someone else to talk to when things feel cold. The second thing is never walk alone. Never walk alone. The book of 2 Corinthians is we. You know, we do not want you to be misinformed. We were under great pressure. We went through this. We did that. We went there. We did this, that, and the other. It's always we, until you get to a little section in chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 12, he writes, "Now when I went to Troas to preach the gospel of Christ and found that the Lord had opened a door for me," Good, good, good news. I still had no peace of mind because I could not find my brother Titus there. So I said goodbye and went on to Macedonia. It was inconceivable for Paul that he would respond to an opportunity for the gospel on his own. He has no embarrassment saying, I had this opportunity, but I didn't take it because I was on my own. Now, we have institutionalized lone leadership, I think, in the Anglican Church. And only now we're beginning to try and work our way around and realize that we've shot ourselves in the foot, I think. So we'll come back to that tomorrow. But are you walking alone? Are there people, not just that you need to talk to about difficult times, but people that you genuinely share the leadership and journey with? Never walk alone. That's number two. Number three, invest in your emotional health. Invest in your emotional health. Chapter one, God is called the Father of Compassion and the God of all comfort. And later on in the book, in chapter 7, Paul writes, God comforted us by the coming of Titus. God comforted. I think comfort has many dimensions. Having a clear conscience, being genuinely loved. There are a whole range of things that invest in us emotionally. And I think often we have the physical thing in mind, or I need to exercise more or eat less, or, you know, we know physically, spiritually also, but the emotional bit, especially when we move to new parishes, we're displaced from our long-term friends, maybe our family have moved away from home. How do we give ourselves the opportunity to feed on the things that feed us emotionally? The people that we love, the things that we enjoy to do. I think creativity is a large part of that for some of us. Sport might be a large part of it. Being involved in organisations. One of my regrets when I was in Southampton is three times I tried to do my City and Guilds in joinery. And I never completed the course because there was always some meeting or another. And I think, why did I not allow myself to finish the course? I could be working as a carpenter now. Oh, that Jesus did the opposite, didn't he? But, you know, it's like, yeah. But are there things that feed your soul that are comforting, that are reassuring, that you don't give yourself permission to do? Paint that painting. Decorate that room. Make that whatever. Kick a ball around. Knock a tennis ball. Whatever it is, give yourself permission for that. Number four, some people in this journey have realized that making some healthy decisions is important. As Paul writes about the beatings and the floggings and the imprisonment, about his thorn in the flesh, you can imagine that physically life was a challenge. Robert McChane, who was an evangelist in Scotland, died at the age of 29. He said, God gave me a horse to ride and a message to deliver, but I've killed the horse and can no longer carry the message. He worked himself to death at the age of 29. It was unhealthy. But, you know, are there healthy decisions we can make? Are there healthy people that we need to connect with? One of the things I love to do is to sort of travel with an author for a period of time. Philip Yancey or Tom Wright or, you know, anybody. If I find something that's inspiring, these days I don't just read their books, I watch some blogs or some sermons. But how can I, C.S. Lewis, how can I draw on his life? If there's a little bit of him that's inspiring, why don't I make the healthy decision to draw on even more of it? And then the last two things. Firstly, managing expectations. In the English covenant on healthy well-being, it says the greatest threat to well-being is unreasonable expectations. I think there's a lot of expectations that we have, and many of them are expectations that we project on other people. Some of them are unhelpful and unhealthy. On an annual basis, I used to sit down with my church wardens and say, can I talk about priorities for the coming year? So that I know, and we've agreed, what I'm giving my best energy to. It doesn't mean that, you know, small groups don't matter, but that'll be next year. This year, let's focus on these things. It released me to say no to things and released me to make sure that I was checking expectations against the insights of other people. And finally, and maybe most importantly, the advice we got was don't look down. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, I love this. It says this. Now, if the ministry that brought death, by which he's talking about the first covenant, was engraved in letters on stone and came with glory, so that the Israelites could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of the glory, fading though it was, will not the ministry of the Spirit be even more glorious? The ministry of the Spirit be even more glorious. That's not an objective evaluation of your productivity. That's a statement that connects what you do to what Christ has done for us and in us. So if you're ever tempted to look down and think, I'm not too good, or other people are doing a better job than me, or my church isn't going very well, or all the kind of things that we sometimes think and we sometimes say, Paul says, don't look down. What you do as you walk with Christ day by day is glorious. It's glorious. And we have the capacity to put a smile on the face of God by choosing to walk with him day by day. Let's just keep a moment quiet, shall we?